was waiting. May it please the court. For the record, my name is Robert Oak, and I represent RFM Industries. The IFR Century Settlement Agreement required Century to purchase certain amounts of flangeway filler from RFR. And pursuant to the settlement agreement, Century ordered the flangeway filler. They sold it, they profited from it, but then they refused to pay RFR for it. Since Century did not pay for the filler, the patent license in the settlement agreement did not take effect. And since there was no patent license, Century's act of selling the filler, knowing that it would be installed in an infringing manner, constituted induced and contributory patent infringement. RFR sued Century in federal district court for patent infringement. When Century still refused to pay, RFR reconsidered its strategy and decided that a quicker way to proceed would be to file a petition to show cause for violation of the permanent injunction. RFR then filed a non-suit without prejudice on the patent infringement suit that had been filed, and did so before Century effectively served RFR with an answer. The district court refused to recognize this non-suit without prejudice and granted Century summary judgment on the pleadings, holding that the patent exhaustion doctrine applied and that there was an implied license between RFR and Century. The court also found the case to be exceptional and awarded attorney's fees under Section 285. There are three issues to be discussed. One is jurisdictional. Did the court have jurisdiction to make its rulings after RFR filed a non-suit without prejudice? Second, whether the patent exhaustion doctrine applied, whether there was an implied license, and whether judgment on the pleadings was properly granted. And third, whether attorney's fees should have been granted under Section 285. First issue, lack of jurisdiction. Before Century effectively served RFR with an answer, RFR filed a non-suit without prejudice, and under the rules, under Fifth Circuit case law, this effectively denied the trial court jurisdiction to proceed any further.
The trial court seemed to think that the faxing of the answer to your office complied with requirements.
Yes, Your Honor. In the order, the district court, I believe, used the word deemed that the faxing of the answer was effective service. However, the trial court followed no accepted or recognized legal principles by deeming that the faxing of an answer constituted effective service. And under the federal rules and under the case law, the faxing of an answer does not constitute effective service under Rule 5.
Unless the parties agreed, made some agreement to accommodation.
Yes, Your Honor.
My position is, even though in the other case they made such an accommodation, it didn't extend to this particular case.
Exactly, Your Honor. There was a written agreement to accept facts in an earlier case.
Same parties.
It involved an additional party. In fact, the
is the earlier case the one we just heard an argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. It is.
And the issues clearly overlap, correct? The same infringing conduct, we're dealing with the same settlement agreement. Argument issue here?
Well, in the first case, RFR sued Rex-Hide for patent infringement, and then Rex-Hide brought in Century on an indemnity claim. In the second claim, Rex-Hide's not involved, RFR sued Century.
So the agreement for the other case for such informal service was between Rex-Hide and RFR, not between Century and RFR?
Initially, the discussions occurred between RFR and Rex-Hide because it was on a discovery issue, my recollection, and then I informed them, my recollection, that service by fax was not sufficient unless it was a written agreement. We entered into a written agreement, and Mr. Emerson's name was added as a party since he was a party to the case. But there was a written agreement in the other case, and if anything, this written agreement should have put Century on notice that if they wanted to have an agreement, or if they wanted to serve by fax, there had to be a written agreement to do that. And that's required by the rules. And there was no written agreement. I believe it's under the federal rules, Your Honor, but I'd have to double check that.
The two cases were never consolidated?
No, Your Honor. Never consolidated. And furthermore, there was no reason for Century to believe that service by fax would be sufficient in a new case, because RFR never accepted service by fax in a new case and never implicitly agreed to service by fax.
Was there some delay in your pointing that the deficiency in service out? I mean, at what point did you say none of them out and raise this issue?
My recollection of the sequence of events was that a complaint and summons, a complaint and then a return of summons was filed. And then Century faxed its answer, filed it with the court. The court issued a scheduling order. And I responded to the scheduling order with a document. In the very first sentence, I said, we desire to non-suit the case without prejudice. The very next document, I stated that. So
the question was the elapsed time between the receipt of the answer and the acted on the assumption that the fax answer was of no effect.
I'm not certain of the calendar time, but as far as the filing documents and the first document that would indicate whether I was going along with the concept that we could have service by fax without an agreement would have been the very next document I filed to court, and that was the document in which I announced that we wish to non-suit the case without prejudice.
But in that document, you didn't articulate, and we're allowed to do that now because we never officially under the rules you see the answer.
I don't have a clear recollection one way or the other on that. That might be implicit in the document because I'm filing it under a rule that allows me to do that before Century properly served RFR an answer. RFR, or Century, has also raised the ECF system, and I've explained that in the brief, that there's a distinction between the ECF system and the ENT system. Assuming arguendo.
Was the other case, the earlier case, 1587, designated for the ECF system?
I don't have a clear recollection.
This one was not.
This one was not.
Which is the official one? And I'm getting confused with the acronyms. Which is the official one, which is not? I mean, the argument is.
The ECF system.
That's the court system. That you agreed would have been official if you had been enrolled.
Yes,
what's the other system called?
The ENT. I think that's electronic notice of transmission. In ENT, you do not consent in writing that you have received.
ECF specifically says that it suffices in lieu of personal service for purposes of Rule 5.
Yes, and it requires the attorneys to consent in writing that electronic notification is service, but that was never done in this particular case. Assuming arguendo that there's jurisdiction, the judgment on the pleadings was improper for two reasons. First, the patent exhaustion doctrine does not apply, and second, no implied license was granted. Under the patent exhaustion doctrine, one of the patents and claims filed upon by RFR was a method claim, and this court has held clearly that the patent exhaustion doctrine does not apply to method claims. Also, the patent exhaustion doctrine requires payment or compensation to the patentee, and there was no payment made by Century. So, clearly, under the case law, the patent exhaustion doctrine does not apply. On implied license, the settlement agreement clearly states that the sale of pop-down filler by RFR to Century is not intended to create an implied license under either patent. The district court just completely ignored this clause when he made his ruling. This court has held that an implied license is granted when the circumstances of the sale plainly indicate that the grant of the license should be inferred. And here, that's just impossible. To infer that because of the express agreement between RFR and Century that the sale.
There was an express license, right?
Pardon me?
There was an express license. You keep arguing there was no implied license. There was an express license, right?
If there was an express license, if Century had made payment, had purchased the flange filler, Century did not purchase. They did not pay. Now, Century has made an argument that there was an express license because they purchased it using a UCC definition. But the UCC should not apply to this settlement agreement because under the predominant purpose test, the predominant purpose of the settlement agreement was to settle the case between the parties and not for the sale of goods.
Mr. Oak, have either of these cases ever been the subject of mediation?
Yes, Your Honor.
If you prevail in either or both of your appeals this morning, even in part, this litigation will drag on more. Everybody will spend a lot more money and a lot more time, and courts will spend more time, magistrate judges, district judges, court of appeals judges in a subsequent appeal. Maybe it's in the interest of the parties, and they certainly have a right to access the system if they want to exercise rights that they have, but it doesn't look like a very business-like way to settle the dispute here. Just an observation.
Well, Your Honor, if I can make a brief comment on that, we have in this case an issue, the indemnification issue, that has basically been a threshold issue. And it's an all or nothing issue. And it's unfortunate that the case has proceeded like this. I agree. But it's a threshold issue.
But if that's an all or nothing issue, let's assume hypothetically. I mean, in this case, what you're trying to do, and you wanted to get your case out of this court, is pursue this issue in another form.
Yes.
But if this issue implies the indemnification issue, as you said, that's all part of this under this umbrella, that issue has already been decided by the district court. It's going to be decided one way or not by us. So what else do you have left to litigate?
Well, if there is no certificate of indemnity, which we allege, then the patent infringement issues come to the front.
But that would be taken care of in that case, though. I mean, that's the case we just heard earlier.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So what I'm asking for is what's left to litigate if, in this case, if you're allowed to withdraw, you want to preserve your right to withdraw so you can do something else. And I'm asking, what else is there to do outside of the indemnification issue that's an issue in the first case?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. We have flangeway filler made by RFAR that has been sold and it's installed in the field. RFAR was never paid for it, so it's infringing. And so what we would do is pursue the petition to show cause for a contempt violation.
Contempt because of failure to pay? Right.
Well, not directly.
So you want to say, you want to pursue contempt under the settlement agreement that say because of the failure to pay, then there was infringement. Not
yeah, the failure to pay is the subject of the arbitration. That's for breach of contract. The failure to pay had the effect of not of the patent license not coming into effect, which resulted in infringement and a violation of the permanent injunction. Two separate things, and two separate causes of action. One for patent infringement and contempt, one for breach of contract.
But I'm having a hard time seeing why the infringement issue isn't part parcel of the indemnification issue in the earlier case. No? Not?
Well, they are related, but they're not exactly the same because you have different remedies for patent infringement than you have for breach of contract. And given the length of time that the flangeway filler has been in place, I would argue that you could have breach of contract damages and you could have additional remedies under patent infringement or for violation of the injunction. The last issue, the case is not exceptional under 285. The court granted judgment on the pleadings because of the patent exhaustion doctrine. Clear error. The court then went on to say that because RFR failed to cite a single case that a patentee must receive payment before the patent exhaustion doctrine will apply, RFR knew or should have known the case was baseless. RFR cited numerous cases, U.S. Supreme Court, this court, district courts, that the patent exhaustion, under the patent exhaustion doctrine, you need payment. So under the, it was clear error because the award of attorney's fees is based on clear error, it is abuse of discretion. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr. Aaron.
Thank you, may I please the court.
This is all one big dispute. Again, the rise out of the original case. When RFR sued Red Tide for infringement, they sued us, we sought indemnity, they refused to indemnify us, we withheld some payments. RFR filed an arbitration. RFR filed this patent infringement case that is before you. Then RFR filed a contempt action. All four of these things were going on simultaneously.
Your references in the record to this, your argument with respect to the electronic filing system, you agree, having
read yes, the yes, that that yes, correct. Yes. I made an assumption that it turned out to be incorrect.
So what's left? I mean, if you weren't notified, if that wasn't sufficient, if the court's filing system wasn't one that's sufficient to satisfy the notice requirements with respect to your answer, why are you still here arguing about whether or not there was no jurisdiction?
Because under the law, the court can excuse improper service of process or improper service of a document if there was actual receipt and there are extraordinary circumstances. There is no dispute before the court that there was actual receipt. And we understand that that alone does not create exceptional circumstances. Exceptional circumstances in this case are as follows. First, like I said, this is all one dispute.
Wait, but the first point is you're saying the district court has discretion. Even if service was not proper under the rules, the district court has discretion to say, okay, let me...
Yes, Your Honor. We are. They can find there are exceptional circumstances that exist that excuse the improper service of
and
this document.
Exceptional circumstances
are here. Look, this is one, again, this is one dispute. Very closely related. Well, I'm getting to that. That is there was a written agreement between the parties in the Rex High, the underlying Rex High case, that said we are going to serve each other and accept service based on or facsimile service. And we agree that didn't explicitly say for any other future lawsuits that arise out of this. But we were in a pattern of serving one another through facsimile. In March of 2005, when this happened,
Mr. Anderson, doesn't that show that when you knew how to do it in one suit, you did it, but you didn't do it in the other?
Well, we knew how to do it by fax in the first suit.
No, but I mean, you knew how to make an agreement that service by fax would be accepted.
That's right, and it was an oversight on our part, absolutely. I wish I could have that back.
Why isn't it fatal that you didn't get an agreement from Mr. Oak that he would accept service by fax? Absent that agreement, it looks like there was never proper service. And in the absence of proper service of an answer, the plaintiff has an absolute right under the civil rules to voluntarily dismiss his case. And the court has no discretion to block that.
Because the courts have found that the improper service can be excused when there is actual receipt and exceptional circumstances. And here, not only did we have the written agreement, not only did we have the course of conduct throughout the years preceding this, there were 2.5 months in between where we dealt with each other regularly over handling the scheduling order. I filed a motion to transfer this case, which was so closely related to the Rexhide case that it was transferred.
You're saying that the things you've mentioned amount to exceptional circumstances?
I'm saying that it was within the court's discretion, yes, sir, to find that given that we had a written agreement.
In a
different case, but it was very closely related. Yes, Your Honor.
But when the cases aren't consolidated, it would seem to matter how closely related they are.
They weren't.
That agreement in case A never binds anybody to anything in case B in the absence of consolidation.
And we're not saying that piece of paper bound them. We're saying that piece of paper, combined with the delay, combined with the fact that this is all one dispute. I mean, papers were flying back. This was March of 2005, right before our trial. Papers are flying back and forth, if you look at the docket sheets, and that a party that files a case that is on its face frivolous to be able to escape its responsibility, its accountability to the courts, simply by saying, well, we got it, two different ways, but it wasn't precisely proper, shouldn't stand. And that's part of our argument as well. So I can...
I still don't quite understand what is extraordinary. They got it, you sent it by fax, they got it by fax, that's undisputed. They're entitled under the rules to be personally served, except when they agree, in writing, to be served non-personally, such as by fax. So, I still don't understand how you get around Rule 5 of the Rules of Procedure.
Because of the actual receipt and extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah, what I'm asking is, why do you feel that these circumstances are extraordinary so as to entitle you to not have to comply with Rule 5? Certainly nothing on their part encouraged you to think that they were waiving Rule 5. So, other than your incorrect assumption, I don't see any justification for not serving them in the normal way to comply with Rule 5.
I'm not claiming that was justified. What we're arguing here is that the court had discretion to find the extraordinary circumstances. And the extraordinary circumstances are the written agreement in this dispute, this underlying dispute, the delay, the nature of their complaint, the course of conduct between the parties. I'm not saying that we should be excused. I'm saying they should not be able to evade responsibility for filing a frivolous lawsuit on these grounds.
But the way Rule 41A1 is written, if I file a frivolous lawsuit and the next day I file a voluntary dismissal, I get away with filing a frivolous lawsuit because the rule entitles me in that scenario to drop the case on day two.
But that's
maybe the rule is stupid because it allows somebody to file a frivolous lawsuit and not be punished for it, but that seems to be what the rule allows nevertheless.
But in this case differs a little bit because they were served, albeit improperly. They were. This isn't a case where they realized their mistake and then, oh, we need to dismiss this case under Rule 41. It's a case where we went along for 2.5 months.
But if that were the standard, then the rule would mean absolutely nothing. We wouldn't, it would mean absolutely nothing. Why not a rule then?
It wouldn't mean absolutely nothing. If he had done what Chief Judge Michelle just mentioned, and that is, they file a lawsuit and then they dismiss it on their own under Rule 41, we wouldn't be here. In fact, remains that we answered, albeit improperly, and went down the road a bit, and then they tried to evade responsibility for filing the underlying lawsuit by dismissing it without prejudice.
So your answer is we should construe the rule as saying it requires a certain type of service except if you don't comply with it. That's fine.
No, Your Honor.
Not sure how you're construing this rule.
I'm construing it the way the courts did in the cases I cited in my brief, which found that if there's actual service in extraordinary circumstances, they will excuse improper service. I'll move next, if you don't have any other questions about service, to the merits of the case. Again, we purchased flangeolet filler from RFR, submitted a purchase order saying we promise to give you money if you promise to send us rubber flangeolet filler parts. That's what happened under the terms of the settlement agreement. Any of the flangeolet filler we buy from RFR, which we did, is subject to an express license. The court doesn't need to go
any
further.
What about the promise to pay? I mean, let's assume hypothetically, and I'm wanting to know what happened here. But let's assume hypothetically that there was a promise to pay here for Century.
There was.
Let's assume hypothetically that Century never paid any money to RFR.
That's right.
Pursuant to the promise to pay.
Yes.
So we should still enforce that agreement, even notwithstanding that Century has never paid?
Well, I'm not sure which part of the agreement you're talking about. They shipped the product in
right, they did everything they were supposed
that's
to.
That's right.
And let's assume hypothetically that Century did nothing that it was required to do. In other words, they failed to pay.
We failed to
Why
pay.
Why isn't non-performance sufficient justification for RFR to sue for infringement?
Because the settlement agreement explicitly says whatever you buy from us comes with a license.
Sure, if you pay for it. Yeah. Mr. Oakes. Standpoint. You don't get it for free. That's ridiculous to say you can sign a contract saying I want 1,000,000 pounds of this rubber and I'll pay you $1,000,000 within 30 days and then they send you a million pounds of rubber and you say, well, guess what? We're not going to pay, but we're going to keep the rubber. And then having breached your obligation under the agreement, you want his obligation to extend the license to still be enforced. It doesn't seem to make any sense. Why aren't all bets off when the basic exchange of promises is frustrated because one side doesn't do what it promised to do, pay for the rubber?
Because this is a sale of goods. What is a sale? They're saying that there is no sale if there is no payment. But there is
no, that's not what he said. What he said is the case law seems to hold that for patent rights to be extinguished, there has to be payment. And here it seems clear there was no payment. Therefore, he says no extinguishment.
Well, even under the definitions that he cites, there was payment. Okay? Black's Law Division, by in his brief, defines purchase as transmission of property founded on a valuable consideration. A promise to pay is valuable consideration. The American Heritage Dictionary.
Wait, it's valuable consideration even if it's never paid?
Yes, because they have a piece of paper that says, we promise to pay you. So they have a remedy under contract for those monies.
And
not under the patent
to,
laws.
Where are they supposed to pursue that remedy, though? Before the district court in Texas here?
Well, that's what the judges ruled just now. So they can pursue it either in the district court, or if they hadn't waived arbitration, they could pursue it in arbitration. But a failure to pay does not mean there wasn't a sale or a purchase here. Now, again, under the UCC, there's a sale when the seller transfers title to the buyer. And title is transferred when the seller delivers the product to the buyer.
We're not talking about UCC law or commodity sales law. We're talking about the patent law. And when a patentee's right to exclude others evaporates. And the case law cited by Mr. Oakes, he says, requires that in the patent context, there be payment for the goods, not just delivery of the goods.
None of the cases say that there must be payment.
Well, they certainly do. They use the exact word payment.
Well, they say that
he
gets the benefit.
He quotes it repeatedly in his brief. I got tired of reading it.
But they get the benefit of the agreement, which is a promise to pay. There is no case law, he cited no case law, in which a failure to pay was later turned into a patent infringement. And if that were the case, I mean, between merchants, normally you've got a 30 or 60 day payment schedule. They ship the product, say we ship it immediately to our customer, and then we pay 30 days later. Is that infringement in the intervening 30 days?
Yeah, but let's take a hypothetical when 5 years have passed and you've still not paid.
Okay, they have rights under contract. They have a
but you still,
piece of paper.
But in your view, you still have the benefit of the bargain that you have a license for those patented goods.
Because the settlement agreement says that anything we buy, any filler that they sell to us, that we purchase, is subject to the license. Comes with a license. We bought it. We set up a purchase order that says, give us that stuff and we'll send you money. Yeah, and because of the circumstances of this huge dispute that is growing like Topsy, they withheld payment for various reasons. But that doesn't turn a breach of contract case into a patent infringement case. Likewise, it couldn't be a case for conversion.
I think we have your points clearly in mind. Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Mr. Oak, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please report? Your Honor, on the last issue, the settlement agreement provided the express license would only take effect if there was a purchase, and in the common meaning of purchase, you've got to provide compensation. If you don't provide compensation, then there's no authority to use the flangeoid filler. And of course, 271 of the patent statute says who without authority makes, sells, uses, offers to sell, has, without authority, has committed patent infringement. So it gives rise to a cause of action.
The other side is, says that, well, you have to leave. You have a promise to pay. It's not that you're left high and dry with nothing, and they get to infringe all they want. You have, by definition, an obligation that they agreed to pay. So you can run into your options are kind of limited, given where you are, but you can go into court or in some court and enforce that promise to pay. Why isn't that sufficient? You think you have an enforceable right to have them pay, right?
Yes, and we thought that's what we thought the application of it.
Right.
The failure to pay within the terms specified between the parties. But when Century fails to pay within those terms, then you don't have a license.
Why isn't it sufficient that you have a breach of contract suit? With all the remedies that come from that. Why do you have to have contract remedies and patent remedies? Why does that make any sense?
Because they are two distinct causes of action. And one, on a breach of contract claim, you are entitled to a certain set of remedies. And on a patent infringement claim, you're entitled to another set of remedies. For example, an injunction.
Let's assume you run into arbitration. Let's assume this case had turned out differently. So you go before an arbitrator, and an arbitrator says, yes, Century is liable to you for $2 million. That's what they promised to pay you. And since they haven't paid in 90 days or 2 years, you get that plus interest. Then would you agree that's the way it plays out? Then you don't have any other cause of action for infringement because now you've had this agreement enforced, and we have to enforce the license part of it as well?
That's an interesting question, and that's one that I addressed in the brief. And I believe there's an argument that given the length of the period of time, you would have contractual remedies for breach of contract, and in addition, you would have remedies for infringement, the infringement that occurred during that period of time.
So you get both. So you say because they arguably allegedly breached the agreement, we get to be paid for what they owed us, including interest, and we get to sue them for infringement. That's your view of the law.
Well, I would say that both causes of action are valid. Now, I would not argue for a double recovery. I would not argue for that. But to the extent you have different remedies under patent infringement.
Yeah, but I thought everybody agreed that this stuff is not even being made any of the time. So the patent remedy of an injunction wouldn't come into play. This process hypothetical indicates full payment plus interest because of the delay. Has been finally made, then what is there left to wring from Century?
Well,
they made good on their obligations belatedly, but they paid interest.
Well, first of all, the flangeoid filler still is being made by my client and sold by my client to various
customers. You're the patentee. You can't get an injunction. You don't need an injunction for something that isn't being done by the adverse party. So well, then only money is an issue, and if they pay the purchase price plus interest, then it looks like on the money side you've been made whole.
Well, the flangeoid filler is still being used out there, and so infringement is continuing. And patent, what I would do is file a petition to show cause for violation of the permanent injunction contempt, and under contempt action, you are entitled to additional remedies in addition to breach of contract remedies. So you have two distinct causes of action with distinct remedies, particularly a motion for contempt, where the judge can order additional things that occur.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll take the two appeals under advisement.